testimony. Do you think he would have admitted it if she emptied out their savings?
Women generally can't just go to a bank and withdraw funds that are there in a husband's name, Anna said.
He shrugged, as if he didn't care to pursue the point.
Anna paused in her slow march back and forth across the room. Then she came to sit on the edge of the bed. You're still thinking that there's a connection between the two cases, she said. But I don't see it. Hundreds of women die from complications of a badly done abortion every year.
Poor women, Jack said, or very young. Have you ever read a newspaper article about a married woman with money who died as the result of an illegal operation?
You're saying that these two cases have something in common that distinguishes them from other failed abortions.
That suggestion seemed to intrigue her.
I don't discredit it out of hand, she said. Can you explain what it is you're seeing that I don't?
Jack thought for a while. Not clearly.
She said, Is your hypothesis that the same person operated on both women?
I think it's possible. They look a lot alike, the two women. Janine Campbell and Abigail Liljestrom were both in their mid-twenties, slender, with a great deal of dark hair and brown eyes, about the same height. I know that there are hundreds of women in the city who fit that description. But think for a moment about this. Both of them already had children and homes. They both had husbands with very good jobs and access to money. They both had reason to fear childbirth. They were both desperate.
Anna drew in a long breath and let it out slowly. You are making a large logical leap about Mrs. Liljestrom.
It's a working hypothesis, Jack said. Tomorrow I'm going to talk to her husband. He's coming in from Buffalo. She had a sister I want to talk to as well.
I wonder why her sister didn't come with her to the appointment in the first place.
Because the sister lives here already, Jack said. And that's another question not answered. Why did she come to New York and stay in a hotel when she could have stayed with her sister?
Because she didn't want her sister to know, Anna said. Do you really think the sister will be willing to talk to you about this?
Jack shrugged a shoulder. I'll do my best to convince her, unless you'd like to come along.
At that, she laughed, clearly pleased and embarrassed both. I wouldn't know where to start.
I think you would.
Yes, well, she said. Tomorrow I have surgery in the morning, and at midday I have an appointment with Father McKinaway on Lafayette Place, at his mission. Now I've surprised you.
Maybe I was just hoping you'd let it go.
She pulled back to examine his expression. Really? You really think we should just let Vittorio Russo go?
He flopped back to lie on the bed, his feet still on the floor. I guess I don't want to see you drawn into the situation. It won't be pleasant.
I'm already drawn in. And if I only did pleasant things...
You wouldn't be you. So when did you make the appointment?
I sent a request in the morning mail and got a reply in the afternoon. I did plan to tell you about it. But then Oscar came and it slipped my mind.
Jack said, I'd go with you if I could.
I'm not going alone, Anna said. I'm taking Elise with me. She might not be a nun anymore, but she still knows how to talk to priests, I should hope.
He made a sound in his throat he hoped she would take as mild disagreement.
She yawned and reclined against him, her head burrowing into the plane of his shoulder. Then she said, If you think of the two dead women as the product of one diseased mind, how do you account for the difference in the way they were treated? Mrs. Campbell's death was very hard, and Mrs. Liljestrom's was quick and relatively painless.
100 answers went through Jack's mind in a rush, but they all came down to the same thing.
The question is, was he more satisfied with his first attempt or his second? Anna jerked in surprise, and for a long time Jack rubbed her back until he felt her give up the images he had put in her mind. He thought she was falling asleep and was thinking about how to rouse her to get under the covers when she spoke again. Why do you assume it was a man? Chapter 33. As it turned out, Elise liked the idea of going to see Father McKinnaway even less than Jack did. When Anna asked her to join her for the interview, color rose in her cheeks, almost as if she had been slapped. You have no reason to tell him your own history, you realize. We're going there to ask about Vittorio Russo. Elise looked doubtful.
But he's a priest, she said. He'll know.
Why would he? Do they send out a notice to all priests in the city when someone leaves a convent?
Of course not.
Then what are you afraid of? That he'll read your mind?
Priests have been known to do just that.
Nonsense, Anna said. You ascribe far too much power to the man.
Or maybe you ascribe too little.
That made Anna smile. He can't drag you back to the convent by the hair. Elise shook her head.
He has a reputation, she said finally, for speaking his mind.
And so do I, Anna said. Now, shall we go? Father McKinnaway had raised funds to build the asylum for homeless boys that spanned a full block on Lafayette. It spoke to his determination and drive, things that Anna did not underestimate. He was a man who cared about the fate of the children he took in, and on that basis, she hoped he would be willing to discuss the Russo case. The building was larger than the New Amsterdam, utilitarian in design and materials, and while Anna imagined that every bed was already filled, there was a deserted air about it. She wondered if most of the boys were out on the streets selling papers and blacking shoes, or if they had someplace else to be. Elise said very little. She walked with her chin to her chest and her arms folded against her abdomen. If he realizes that you were once a nun, it will be because of your posture and the way you stare at the ground, Anna said. Look at people directly when they talk to you. I know it's not easy after so many years of hiding away, but it's a crucial skill to learn.
I've been trying, Elise said dryly. It's a hard habit to break.
Anna felt a flush of embarrassment. I apologize, she said, for patronizing you. Elise stopped, surprised.
You have nothing to apologize for. I owe you everything.
No, you don't, she said firmly. I am simply lending a hand to a promising student. All the work is yours. And while I'm lecturing you on your habits, I should at least be doing as much for myself. One side of the wide mouth curled up in what Anna took for reluctant agreement. Let's face the lion together, she said, and opened the door for Elise to pass through first. I am Dr. Anna Savard, and this is Nurse Elise Mercier. We have an appointment with Father McKinnaway. The young man who sat at the reception desk sorting through papers glanced up at them. Anna felt herself judged, but whatever conclusions were reached, he hid them away well. Father McKinnaway's office is down the hall. He spoke English with an accent that could have been German or Danish, a young man of maybe 20 years. Not a priest or a monk by his clothes. He gestured with his head to point them in the right direction. It's clearly marked. Before they had turned away, he spoke to Elise. Do I recognize your face?
I don't know, Elise said. Do you?
I'm good with faces.
But I'm not. I'm sorry. I don't remember you.
But he continued to study her. his curiosity overriding common good manners. He said,
I'm Elmo Chirner, from Holland.
A little color came into Elise's cheeks.
I'm sorry, I don't recognize your face or your name.
Are you Irish? You have the coloring, that red hair.
I'm not, Elise said. Pardon me, we need to be going.
Was it something I said?
He called after them, and Anna saw a spark of surprise and pleasure in the younger woman's face. The halls echoed with the sounds of boys' voices reciting lessons, multiplication tables primarily. From farther away, there was the faint echo of hammers and saws. There was still the bite of fresh lumber in the air, and just below that, lye soap.
It feels very familiar, Elise said. Like every other orphan asylum and mission I've seen, it's good that they get lessons, don't you think?
Anna did agree. Homeless children needed food and shelter and someone to care about their welfare and their futures. Father McKinaway certainly took those needs to heart. And, she told herself, that was reason enough to respect the man, sight unseen, even given Elise's clear concerns. The first door they came across had Father John McKinaway stenciled in plain black on wood painted a dull green. It stood half open, but Anna knocked anyway, pushing the door open as she did. The man standing at the window turned to them, iron gray eyebrows jumping high on a shiny pink forehead.
Is it that time already?
He looked at a clock hanging over the door.
So it is. Come in, come in. Did you find your way without difficulty?
Mr. Chirner was helpful, Anna said.
Yes, a fine lad. Excellent manners. I was lucky to find him. Now, which one of you is Dr. Savard?
It took a moment for them to satisfy the need for polite introductions, and then Anna and Elise sat down across a desk as broad as a boat. It was covered with papers and binders and books, but everything seemed to be carefully ordered.
Now, how can I help you?
Anna took in a deep breath and told the story of the Russo children, starting with the church basement in Hoboken. She had decided to say nothing of Staten Island in the hope that he would volunteer the information. As she talked, she watched his face, broad and unremarkable and unreadable.
You've gone to a lot of trouble for these children, he said when she had finished.
We've done what we can. We'd like to do more.
Why? Why these four children? Why not some other children?
Anna hesitated.
I don't have a good answer for that, except that Rosa made an impression on me.
You pitied her?
Anna wondered if this was a provocation.
I felt compassion for all the children, but her situation I found particularly difficult. May I ask why this is relevant?
He made a tent of his hands, the fingers touching his chin.
The children in my care are vulnerable.
His gaze pivoted to Elise.
Miss Mercier, he said, what's your interest in the fate of these children?
At first, Anna thought that Elise would simply not answer, but then she cleared her throat.
I was there when the two boys went missing. I'd like to help in any way I can.
You feel responsible?
She nodded.
Yes, I do.
Father McKinaway, Anna said, we would like to ask you about the youngest of the children, Vittorio Russo. We believe that he was taken to the Foundling on the 26th of March, and that you found him there and took him away with you the next day.
He blinked at her with what she thought was meant to be seen as mild surprise. Why ever would you think that?
We went to the Foundling and looked at the records. Sister Mary Irene remembered the boy because of his unusual coloring. She was very helpful.
More helpful than I can be. I'm afraid I have no information for you.
His expression was stony, even hostile. You may not remember that you answered a letter of mine some weeks ago and suggested I come see you at Mount Loretto on Staten Island. My husband and I did in fact go to Staten Island on the 26th of May, but you had been called away because of some emergency. He had a polite but empty way of looking at her, as if he were humoring her need to tell a story. Brother Jerome gave us a tour, and then we went for a walk on the beach. That's when we happened to see Vittorio with his adoptive family. He was introduced as Timothy Mullen. We didn't intrude or ask questions, but I am certain that the boy called Timothy is in fact Vittorio. The empty expression gave way to irritation.
Did this child you think is Vittorio Russo seem to be suffering in some way? Underfed, abused, uncared for?
No, Anna said. He looked very content, and he is clearly much loved. Did you place him with the family, Father McKinaway?
I know nothing about a child called Vittorio Russo, said the priest. Let me clarify something for you, Dr. Savard. Adoptions are private and anonymous. They are not discussed with anyone for any reason. Once a child has been adopted into a family, there is no turning back. It would be terrible for the child and the adoptive parents both. I'm sure you would agree that a child in the situation you've described has been through enough and shouldn't be wrenched from a stable and loving family.
So you are saying that Timothy Mullen is not, in fact, Vittorio Russo? A line appeared between his brows, as if she were a dull student giving him a headache.
As I have said, I cannot help you.
Let me understand, Anna said. If a child were separated from his parents in an emergency, a fire, for example, and they came to you in the hope you might know something of their missing son, a child you had taken in, you would lie to them.
That isn't the situation at hand.
But if the child already has a family,
does this boy you're asking about have parents?
Anna pulled up. They are both deceased, but he does have sisters who love him and miss him.
Dr. Savard, the priest said with great solemnity, I will try again to make you understand. Where we can, we find good, stable Catholic families to adopt orphaned children, and then we step back and allow those families their privacy. I can't talk to you about any case, even in hypothetical terms. Do we understand each other now?
I understand that I have to tell two little girls who have lost everything that their brother is lost to them too, because the church won't allow them to be reunited. The smooth pink mouth puckered.
You are used to getting your way, Dr. Savard. But this time you will not.
The girls are Catholic, Anna said. As a priest, would you care to explain your position to them? He smiled at her.
Certainly. You may bring them to see me any time. Now tell me, who has legal custody of these two Catholic children? Are they being raised in the church?
Anna gave him the same insincere smile as she got to her feet. That is not a topic open to discussion, with anyone for any reason. I want you to know that I may decide to talk to the Mullen family without your permission. There had been some condescension in his manner, and now that disappeared entirely.
Do not test me, Dr. Savard.
But you are having such a grand time testing me, Father McKinaway. And turnabout is fair play, even for Catholics.
Elise said, I feared as much. I'm so sorry. I'm not finished yet. They turned from Great Jones Street onto Fourth Avenue, walking briskly. Elise wondered if it would be best to leave the subject until Dr. Savard had time to gather her thoughts, but then decided it was best not to hesitate. He will do what he can to stop you, she said. And what would that be? Will he try to have me arrested, do you think? She produced a sour smile. Would you really approach the family? Dr. Savard stopped and looked at her. I might,
Do you have objections?
Concerns?
Elise didn't look away.
Yes, there is no shortage of concerns.
Her posture relaxed quite suddenly.
Don't worry that I'm going to go marching off to Staten Island to confront the Mullen family. I have no interest in hurting them. We'll talk about it at home when the girls are asleep and decide how to proceed. Does that put your worries to rest?
Elise said.
I don't know.
Fair enough, said Dr. Savard. Neither do I. They walked back to the New Amsterdam in silence. Detectives like to think of themselves as foolproof, able to tell an honest man from one who played at being honest. In Jack's view of things, this was true much of the time, but only because the first lesson learned on the job was not to trust anybody about anything. Something like Anna's work, where she had to assume that all patients lied, whether they meant to or not. Harry Liljeström wasn't lying about anything. His wife's death had torn him in two. At the morgue, he stood looking at her remains with tears streaming down his face. Jack stood back to leave the man his privacy, then took him to the Gilsey house, where he had arrangements to make and a bill to settle. I have questions, Jack said. But if you'd like to wait until tomorrow... Liljeström was ashen, almost as if he were about to faint.
I have to get back home. Ask your questions now.
They sat in a quiet corner of the hotel's main lobby. Liljeström cleared his throat, wiped his face with a sodden handkerchief, straightened his shoulders, and looked Jack in the eye. Jack decided that the direct approach would be best. He said,
There was a post-mortem. Your wife died of blood loss following an operation.
He waited, watching Liljeström's expression. He was a man like a thousand others in the city. Someone Jack might have walked past every day and never noticed. But there was a dignity about him, and when he spoke, his tone was even and unapologetic.
We have two children, he said, healthy, beautiful children, a boy and a girl. But the first confinement was hard and the second even worse. Our doctor said that she was unlikely to survive a third pregnancy. So you are aware of the operation she had?
The man had very pale blue eyes, almost colorless.
Yes. She missed twice, you see. And we decided together that it was the right thing to go to a doctor who could bring her courses on. I wanted to come with her, but she refused. It wasn't the first time, and she thought she had nothing to fear.
Jack said,
She had the procedure done previously. By the same doctor? She had it done once before, but that doctor died, and she decided she didn't want to approach anyone else near home. We've heard of women being blackmailed, you see.
Jack sat back.
Well, no, I haven't run into that before. Does it happen often? I don't know, said Liljeström. I only know of one case, a lady who goes to our church. Her daughter was in trouble, and so they went to a doctor who could fix the problem. Afterward, his nurse threatened the lady that she'd tell everybody about her daughter's shame if she didn't give her money. How do you know this?
Jack asked.
Because the lady is a close friend of my wife's. Was a close friend.
His eyes filled with tears. Jack concentrated for a moment on his notebook, and then in an even tone he said,
Do you know the doctor's name? The one your wife came to see. Anything about him? I only know that she was confident about his qualifications, and that his office is here in the city in a safe neighborhood. To be clear, we believe that what happened to your wife might have been done with malice aforethought. Any information you have could be helpful in bringing the responsible party to account,
Jack said. Color flooded the man's face, rising from his neck like mercury in a thermometer.
You mean to say this wasn't a simple error by the surgeon?
We have reason to believe that it may well have been premeditated. It's still under investigation. And so perhaps you'll understand why any information at all is important.
I would tell you if I knew.
All I can say with certainty is that he charged $250 and was supposed to provide nursing care for up to 3 days or until she was ready to come home.
He let out a harsh laugh, then pressed his handkerchief to his eyes.
He put her in a cab and sent her to a hospital. I know that I'd kill him with my own two hands if he were standing here with me, and if it meant going to the gallows.
Would your sister-in-law know more about your wife's arrangements?
Liljestrom's head came up quickly.
No. She had no idea that Abigail was here. She wouldn't have approved.
So it wasn't Mrs. Liljestrom's sister who gave her the name of the doctor. Did she have other close friends in the city?
No. I really don't know how she found him. Believe me, if I knew who was responsible, I wouldn't keep it to myself. Are we almost done? I have arrangements to make. I want to take her home, the children and her parents.
He closed his eyes briefly and then let out a long sigh.
Just one more question, Jack said. They gave you her things at the morgue, and you've been through her room here. Is anything missing? Jewelry? Anything of value?
She didn't bring jewelry with her when we traveled,
Liljestrom said.
It's still at home in the safe. Her wedding ring was on the bedside table in her room.
He stood abruptly.
You have my address if you have more questions.
Jack shook Liljestrom's hand.
I'm very sorry for your loss. Would you like to be notified when we find the responsible party? I want to know when he's dead,
said Harry Liljestrom.
I want to know that he's burning in hell.
Anna sometimes woke suddenly in the middle of the night, her heart hammering, sure that something crucial had been forgotten and left undone. Most usually, Jack went right on sleeping. She wondered if it should irritate her that he was so impervious to her sleeplessness, and decided that it did not. It would be unfair, and beyond that, these short episodes provided her with the rare opportunity to study his face without embarrassing either of them. He teased her about her inability to accept compliments, but he disliked being studied and would go to lengths to distract her when she did. Extreme lengths, on occasion. In the dimmest light, she saw that his eyes were moving behind closed lids, scanning for trouble even in his dreams. Almost a week had passed, and they had made no progress with Mrs. Liljestrom's case. There was still no indication of where she had gone the morning she died, or how she had found the person who operated on her. Apparently, a case like this one became more difficult to solve with every passing day. Oscar and Jack were still convinced that there was a connection between Janine Campbell and Abigail Liljestrom, something they had missed. Anna wished, as she did every day, that Sophie were here to talk through this with her. Sophie had always been the better diagnostician, able to jump with dexterity from fact to fact, weaving them together until she had spun an answer. Now Jack turned on his side and gave her his back, broad and high and hard as a wall. As if he had heard her thinking and was irritated with her inability to see something so obvious. She moved so her face almost touched the back of his head. Better to draw in his smell, soap and shaving cream and something peppery. The very essence of Jack Mezzanotte himself. She drifted back to sleep, just exactly in that position. With the first light, she woke again. Jack was talking, but not to her. He sometimes had long conversations in his sleep, always in Italian. Another thing on her list, as yet not even begun, Italian lessons. At least, Italian lessons that she could put to use in company. Everything Jack taught her was very much focused on the personal. It made her blush to think of it. And then she was irritated with herself for blushing. A trained physician familiar with every aspect of human anatomy and physiology, and he could make her blush. He delighted in making her blush. She would learn Italian if for no other reason than to scold him when he was being outrageous. Somehow she would make room in her day. One more difficult but not impossible task on a long list, with Vittorio Russo and Father McKinaway at the top. For the sake of the little girls, but also for her own sake, she needed to make a plan, come to some kind of resolution. The problem was that she didn't really know what she wanted, what was best for Vittorio or Rosa and Leah, the Mullins and everyone else. The subject was never very far from her mind. Just a few days ago, Jack had made an observation that had struck her to her core, though he didn't seem to realize it. For Rosa, he had said, losing a brother was like losing a part of herself. She had failed him in her own mind, if nobody else's, and would never forgive herself. It wasn't often that Anna allowed herself to think about her own brother. Even after so much time, it was almost too painful to bear. One day soon she would need to talk about Paul, pull out the few memories she had, and explain it all to Jack. The last person she had told about him was Rosa, standing in the basement of a Hoboken church with her youngest brother held protectively to her heart. Chapter 34. At the dinner table on Saturday evening, the little girls were more excited than usual. A long summer afternoon out of doors, running between roses and weeds, had not slowed them down at all. They fidgeted and giggled and whispered, waiting impatiently for Jack to come to the table. He came in late, almost 24 hours since he had been called out on a robbery. He went around the table kissing cheeks, something he had done one evening, not realizing he was initiating a routine he would never be allowed to forsake. He ended with Anna and slid into his place with a sigh. Margaret said, "Go on, girls, or you'll burst with the news." Leah jumped in place.
"Il palazzo delle erbacce è finito."
"No," Rosa corrected her sister.
"We shouldn't call it weeds anymore because there are no weeds. Not one."
"Too late," Jack said. "Once a name sticks, it's stuck for good. Ask Anna about that. She'll tell you."
Rosa wrinkled her whole face, trying to decide whether to argue. Then she set the subject aside.
"It is finished," she repeated. "Your sisters put up the last curtains, and Giorgio and—"
She hesitated.
"Mario."
Chiara supplied her with the name she was missing. Anna was continually surprised that Rosa remembered as much as she did, given all the mezzanotte cousins who had been in and out during the renovation. She herself didn't remember exactly where Mario and Giorgio fit into the family tree. Rosa was saying,
"And Mario finished with the gas lights, and now it's ready."
Anna turned to Jack.
"Really? It's ready?"
One eyebrow peaked.
"I'm as surprised as you are."
Chiara said,
"Just in time for the picnic."
Now Jack's look of surprise was more genuine.
"That's tomorrow."
Anna said,
"Jack, we've been talking about it all week," and saw that he was grinning.
"We're all going," added Margaret.
"Unless you have to go chase robbers again,"
Rosa said to Jack.
"Or Auntie Anna needs to sew somebody back together,"
Leah added. Her small face took on a troubled look, as if she imagined that possibility for herself. Anna tried not to smile as the girls related the plans for the next day in a manner that was worthy of a stage production. Every Italian in the whole United States, as Leah understood it, would be coming to their own park, just down the street, to eat and sing and dance and listen to music by the 7th Regiment Band. Under the direction, Chiara added with considerable pride,
of Uncle Kappa.
Margaret sat up straighter at this, and directed an incredulous look directly at Jack.
Carlo Kappa is your uncle?
Not exactly, Jack said. His daughter Susanna is married to my brother Matteo. He's my... I don't know. What do you call your sister-in-law's father?
Uncle, said Leah in a decisive tone. You call everybody aunt or uncle, said Rosa.
Leah looked both furious and terribly affronted. Anna said,
I'm happy to be called aunt, or uncle, if you prefer, Leah.
The girls gaped, and then all of them, Elise included, burst into laughter. Jack held up a hand as if he were directing traffic, and the laughter cut off.
I can't allow that, he said in his most serious tone. No Uncle Anna here unless I can be Aunt Jack.
Aunt Quinlan was smiling, but her eyes were damp.
Yes, she said. That's the house rule. Aunts and uncles and grandmas and grandpas all around. For anyone who needs one at any time.
After dinner, Jack wanted to go for a walk. Anna suspected because he had something to talk about that he didn't want others to hear. They started out in the direction of Washington Square, passing a group of young men coming out of New York University in high spirits, charwomen on their way home, and Mr. Pettigrew, a neighbor. He stopped right in front of them, all but demanding an introduction that was, strictly speaking, overdue. They should have gone to see all the neighbors as a newly married couple, but as they had done everything unconventionally, the visits had been put off. Jack was attentive and friendly to Maynard Pettigrew, but his smile was a little strained. When they had finally extracted themselves and crossed the street to enter the park, Jack took her hand and pulled her arm through his, so they were walking as close as they could without tripping over each other's feet. He said,
Tell me about your day.
It wasn't very good.
Tell me anyway.
She thought for a long moment and told him about the 14-year-old girl with syphilis, a mouth full of suppurating ulcers, and ascites.
Ascites is a condition where a lot of fluid builds up in the abdomen so that it looks bloated. It can be very uncomfortable.
And what causes that?
Nothing very good. Possibly cancer, more likely liver failure, as she spends most of her time at the Grand Duke's Theater and lives off nothing but stale beer.
Why is it the police keep closing that place down, only to have it open again a few days later? With his free hand, Jack rubbed his thumb against his fingers in the universal signal for hard cash. Anna, expecting nothing less, shook her head. I aspirated a half gallon of exudate to give her some relief, but she'll probably be back again before long. If she stops drinking immediately, her liver could recover. I sent inquiries to some of the missions, see if anyone has room for her. If she comes back, of course.
You're right, Jack said. You didn't have a very good day.
And I only gave you the highlights.
But then, neither did you, by the face you're making. No progress with the Liljestrom case.
Just the opposite, he said. Another case a lot like it.
They came to the bench where they had once sat together, when they had barely known each other. She tugged, and he sat down. There was a lovely evening breeze, and from not very far off, the sound of children romping with a very excited dog. From an open window came something that Anna thought was supposed to be music, an oboe being played very badly, but with real enthusiasm.
I'm listening, she said.
A woman called Eula Schmidt was found dead in her hotel room this morning.
Not the Gilsey house again.
The Windsor. A lot of valuable jewelry and a wardrobe full of expensive clothes. Better off than Mrs. Liljestrom.
What did the coroner have to say?
At first, he thought it was...
He paused to take a notebook out of his jacket pocket. An ectopic pregnancy. But they did a post-mortem at Bellevue this afternoon.
Abortion, then?
He inclined his head.
Maybe 2 days ago. She died of the same thing as Janine Campbell. Peritonitis. Did I get that word right?
Anna nodded. He said,
But all we have on her is a name, and that may not even be real. No identification, not even a monogram on a handkerchief, or a label on her luggage. A few dollars in her purse, no train or steamer tickets, nothing. I asked the doctor who did the autopsy, McNamara is his name, if there was any sign of previous pregnancies, and he said yes, ample evidence. The hotel staff doesn't know anything about her except that she paid for her room a week in advance 4 days ago. She hasn't stayed there before, that anybody remembers.
Anna closed her eyes to think for a moment. It was getting harder to dismiss the idea that the cases were related.
What does your captain think?
He gave us a couple days to look into it. Oscar is already going through the newspaper ads. He's got a couple of the new patrol officers working with him.
The newspaper advertisements? There must be hundreds of them.
Try to stop him when he gets an idea in his head. Anyway, the man never sleeps.
Anna said, I can't imagine why somebody would be doing this. There's no logic to it.
No logic that you see or I see. But whoever it is, he's settling in now for the longer haul.
The longer haul. The phrase struck her as particularly brutal. The idea that someone had set himself a lifelong task that involved condemning women to terribly painful deaths.
Jack was saying, It's the worst kind of situation. He's dedicated. He doesn't rush.
He was still assuming the guilty party was a man, which was likely, after all. Women killed with poison. Men made a science of inflicting pain.
Do you know other cases like this one?
He glanced at her. It's not something the police are proud of. But there are at least a couple others, and not just here. There's an unsolved case in Texas with 5 dead over 2 years, and a couple in England. One of those has been going on for 5 years at least. Men who get a taste for a certain very specific kind of crime. The ones who can control themselves and stick to a plan are almost impossible to catch. Unless they get sloppy, most of them will live to a ripe old age and die in their beds. The scientists working on fingerprints seem to think they can come up with a way to identify and keep track of suspects, but nobody knows when that will be.
She rubbed her cheek against his shoulder. So you'll be working tomorrow.
He read her thoughts, as he did so often, and leaned over to kiss the corner of her mouth.
Just in the morning. Couldn't miss the June picnic. Even if you didn't mind, Oscar would. So where do we sleep tonight, Mrs. Mezzanotte?
I don't mind, Anna said. But we do have a lot to move, clothes and all the rest.
Then not tonight.
He kissed the other corner of her mouth, nibbling softly until she laughed and pushed him away.
Also, there's the small matter of food. We need to talk about a housekeeper, Jack. I don't have the time for cooking or any of the rest of it.
He sat back. I promised your aunt that we'd have supper with them, every evening.
There was nothing to do about that but laugh. And she made me promise that we'd eat breakfast with them.
She's determined,
Jack said. Anna hummed. I could think of a few other words that might serve better. And still, we will need someone for the laundry and cleaning and all the rest of it. Really, this is something we should have thought of to start with.
Anna,
Jack said, slipping his hand to the nape of her neck, threading his fingers into the twist of her hair and tugging so that goose flesh ran down her spine.
It won't take much effort to find a solution,
and think what we're getting in return. A place of our own, family close by, but real privacy, the kind we haven't had yet, not even on Staten Island, with maids coming and going and walls too thin for your enthusiasm.
Why, you!
He caught her hands to protect himself, pulled her closer to put his arms around her shoulders and hold her still, laughing like a boy very satisfied with a prank. An older couple walked by, the lady making her disapproval known by clucking her tongue. A spasm of irritation passed over Jack's face and she felt him tense. And so Anna did the logical thing, damn the disapproval on a beautiful summer evening. She kissed him, and getting up, she pulled him onto his feet.
Let's go try out the privacy. See if it lives up to your expectations and my enthusiasms.
Jack said, did you notice the size of the bathtub?
Chapter 35. Elise had a free day, though she had protested she needed no such indulgence. The matron had insisted, and so that morning she woke to the sound of church bells, thinking of Mass. She should get up now and dress and go with Mr. and Mrs. Lee and the Russo girls. She had left the convent, but not the church. She rolled onto her stomach and buried her face in one of the fat pillows that she had so quickly come to appreciate. They wouldn't badger her if she stayed behind. They wouldn't need to badger her, because she would be doing enough of that for all of them. With a groan, she rolled out of bed and set about getting ready.
One thing at a time, she told herself, one change at a time. They would walk to church, the little girls skipping ahead with spring hats pinned firmly in place. She liked walking and being out in the city when the weather was so fine. She liked Mr. and Mrs. Lee.
What she dreaded was the sight of the confessionals in a row along one wall. She hadn't left the church, but neither had she been to confession since she got on the train for the city, and that in itself was something to atone for.
Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. I miss nothing at all about the convent. I miss none of the sisters who taught me and cared for me. I love this world and the place I have in it, the work I do and the things I'm learning, and I go all day without praying or even thinking of it.
She heard Rosa and Leah burst out of their room. Margaret called after them, a litany of manners to be remembered. They called back, agreeing cheerfully to anything and everything in the need to be moving. Elise followed them, smiling to herself.
Anna went in on Sunday morning to check on a patient who, as it turned out, had died in the night. It was not unexpected, but sad nonetheless. She spoke to the husband, an old man who shuddered with palsy and grief, while she wrote out the death certificate, asking questions with the help of one of the nurses who spoke Italian. He answered in a wavering voice. Anna Maria Vega had been born on the first day of March in the year 1810 in Ragusa, Sicily, to Emilio and Anna Teresa Vega. To this, Anna added the fact that she died in New York on a mild summer night of an abdominal aortic aneurysm, one that had been plain to diagnose and inoperable. Before Anna left the ward, another nurse stopped her and she wrote three more death certificates, and then walked down to the clerk's office, where she would sign them in his presence so that he could file them with the coroner. The office door stood open, but there was no sign of the clerk. Anna sat down to wait. If she went back to the wards, she would be drawn into one case or another and might not get away in time for the picnic. She was actually looking forward to finally meeting the mezzanotes she had been hearing about. It would be easier in this setting than any other. The picnic and all the rest of it would come to an end, and she could escape. It was the word that came to mind. She wondered if Jack realized how unsettled she was by the prospect of so many new relatives all at once. She wondered, too, if he had engineered the previous evening,
if he realized that her muscles would still be twitching, overstimulated from a single hour in the bath. It was hard to worry about much at all when her mind kept wandering back to him, wrapped around her, hot water and soap and sliding skin. She stood up to go to the window and noticed a newspaper on the desk, folded open to the advertisements. Thinking of Oscar Maroney, she picked it up and began to scan the small print, column after column of breathless announcements for cocoa, short pants, pianos, beer, seaside vacations, miracle cures, straw hats, Macassar oil, crocodile handbags, vaporizing inhalers, musicales, calligraphic pens, Brussels lace, cigars, felt tooth polishers, and hair renewers. When she came to the listing of physicians in private practice, she sat down and glanced through the announcements. Addresses, office hours, areas of expertise, educations. Interspersed with the legitimate offerings were the questionable ones. Married and single ladies in need of medical consultation of a private and personal nature can turn with confidence to Dr. Crane, who has had the finest medical education available. 20 years in practice. Simple removal of all obstructions to nature's rhythms. Modern hygienic methods, safe and discreet. Box 29, Broadway Post Office. All inquiries answered by mail within a day. Respectable ladies requiring specialized medical care and treatment should be aware that Dr. Weiss, a specialist in the very particular needs of the weaker sex, renowned for his kind, professional, and efficient methods, is seeing patients at his offices in the Hughes Building. Ladies in distress, and without other recourse, married or maiden, may apply to Dr. Sanders, a physician and professor of women's indispositions with many years' experience. Inquiries to the Park Avenue Post Office, Box 4. By return mail, you will receive a description of services offered. Specific details of your case will make a detailed response, including costs possible. She counted 30 ads of the same type, and estimated twice as many for pills and teas guaranteed to restore a lady's health and circulation, a euphemism that always set Anna's teeth on edge, as if a woman's menstrual cycle were an ailment that required a male's better understanding to bring under control. If she took the time to go through the dozens of daily newspapers, she would find hundreds of ads that targeted the most desperate, and none of them could provide the help they claimed to offer. The reputable doctors and midwives who performed abortions didn't advertise at all, and were, by necessity, extremely cautious in accepting patients. She read on, skimming the more personal and for the most part undecipherable ads. AY, all is prepared. Tomorrow at 8 at the agreed place. WGG. Were AY and WGG eloping? Or committing adultery? Or planning a robbery? It struck her as quite understandable that people might be caught up in the mystery and intrigue of what could be taken as very short stories, ripe for development. Mrs. Lee and Aunt Quinlan sometimes talked about them as if the parties were old acquaintances. Anna wondered what Jack and Oscar thought they might gain by going through newspaper advertisements, and if they intended to investigate every one of the practitioners who made outlandish and irresponsible claims under false names. As she folded the paper to put it back on the desk, another ad caught her eye. While she was studying it, the clerk came in. Anna nodded impatiently at the long-winded excuse for his absence and held up the paper. "Is this yours, Mr. Andrews?" He was tall and slender to the point of emaciation, his skin livid with inflamed eruptions that a luckier person would have outgrown years since. Anna imagined very well that he never looked at his reflection if he could help it. Now sweat broke out on his brow because she had looked at him. She turned her attention back to the paper. "You're not in any trouble," she said in a kinder tone.
I came in with some death certificates and noticed the paper. I was just wondering if I might take this page of advertisements, or if that would interrupt your reading.
He raised both hands, palms out, as if he were surrendering to a greater military power.
Please, he said, help yourself.
Jack and Oscar knocked on Archer Campbell's door at 10 in the morning, and kept knocking until they heard him cursing as he marched through the house. He yanked the door open to glare at them, his eyes bloodshot and red-rimmed. His sleeves were pushed up to the elbows, his hands and forearms scalded red and dripping with water and soap suds. His trousers were wet from the knee to the ankle, and his shoes were scuffed and caked with dirt.
What do you want?
A few questions, Oscar said. His tone was not so sharp as Jack would have anticipated.
I've got a few of my own, said Campbell, but I doubt you'll have any answers. Fucking useless buggers, every one of yous.
They followed him into the house, through the small parlor and dining room, to a kitchen that had been emptied of furniture, and the windows and rear door stood wide open. The room smelled of lye soap and carbolic. They stepped around a bucket and a scrub brush and followed him into the yard, where a wash tub full of clothes waited.
Get on with it, Campbell said, or were you expecting cake and coffee first?
Oscar said, how much money did your wife take with her when she left with the boys that Wednesday morning? Campbell's head jerked up.
What?
How much money?
Never mind. Why would you care?
We're trying to track down the doctor who treated her, Jack said.
Money is relevant. She never lacked a thing, Campbell said hotly. Her or the boys.
Oscar glanced at Jack, but they kept their silence. Campbell put back his head and looked up into the sky. After a long moment, he said,
she took it all. $1,222, every penny I've saved since I started to work on the day I turned 11.
You kept it in the house.
Show me a man who puts his trust in a bank and I'll show you a fool. It was well hidden, that you can believe, but not well enough. It never occurred to me that she'd have the guts to rob her own husband. But then, as it turns out, I didn't know her at all, did I?
Have you given up the search for your boys? Campbell's expression hardened.
With what money? Train fares and private detectives and all the rest cost plenty.
He glanced over his shoulder, as if he were worried about being overheard.
She planned it all out. Took the money so she could pay the doctor, the one who fixed her and did such a grand job of it. I think she already knew how things stood, that she was dying, so she paid somebody to take all four boys in. She stole my savings and used it to hide my boys from me, tied my hands so I couldn't go looking for them proper. Miserable bitch. I'll never get the stink of her out of my house.
Anna left the New Amsterdam and hailed a cab, headed all the way uptown on Bloomingdale Road to a little farm that had been one of her favorite places as a child. It was a trip she and Sophie and Aunt Quinlan each made once a month, but Anna had last visited in March, the week before she went to Hoboken. Amelie would not make accusations, but Anna was regretful nonetheless. When the cab driver balked about going so far, she promised him an extra dollar on top of his normal fare if he would wait for her. He stopped in front of the garden gate, heavy with twining flower vines studded with blossoms as big as saucers, bright blue in the sunlight. The farm belonged to Amelie, her cousin. Her half-cousin, really, who was just 65, but had given up her midwifery practice. These days, she never left home. She hadn't come to Sophie's wedding, and wouldn't have come to Anna's if there had been one. Amelie had withdrawn from the world. It was that simple. And more than that, she kept her reasons to herself. At the garden gate, Anna stopped a minute to look and take comfort in the fact that nothing changed here. A small barn in good repair, a pasture where sheep and a donkey and a very old horse grazed, and the small cottage surrounded by a garden where chickens scuffled and scoured the earth. The herbs that grew along the walkway, mint, comfrey, sage, thyme, tansy, pennyroyal, blue cohosh, mugwort, verbena, rue, rioted on the very edge of anarchy, which was true of the whole garden. Abundance was the word that came to mind.
Beauregard, she said,
surprised to see Amelie's old dog sleeping in his usual spot. She always went away thinking he'd be gone before she returned, but here he was. His eyes were milky with cataracts, but his tail thumped at the sound of her voice. She crouched down to rub the crown of his head, and he flopped over onto his back to offer his belly instead.
"Doesn't matter how old he gets," said a familiar voice from the far side of the garden. "He demands his toll. Anna Savard, look at you."
Anna got up and wound her way through the garden beds. Cabbage, squash, carrots, cucumbers, parsnips, beans, peas, turnips, until she reached Amelie, who got up from her weeding and held out both arms.
"Beauregard ain't the only one whose toll has to be paid. Come here and give me my due."
Her arms were thin, but she hugged Anna with all her strength. Then she stepped back and caught up her hands to squeeze them. Her hazel eyes were damp with tears, but if Anna were to point this out, she would deny it.
"Don't you look more like Birdie every day? Bless her sweet soul. Come on now, these weeds ain't going nowhere. They'll wait on me, but I'll bet you're in a hurry."
At that moment, Anna would have gladly forgotten everything and everyone else just to spend the afternoon working in the garden with Amelie. It was Amelie who had delivered her, far away from this tidy farm, on the very edge of the endless forest. Anna promised herself that before the summer was out she would come for a whole day and bring Jack with her. Jack should hear Amelie's stories from Amelie herself.
"Sophie and Cap were here right before they sailed," Amelie was saying over her shoulder. "I hope you won't be mad that they told me your news. And don't start apologizing. I know how busy you are."
"I should apologize," Anna said.
"But don't. Come in the kitchen. I've got cake."
Anna followed the winding path to the back of the house, lined with bushes and flower and alive with bees and hummingbirds. As a little girl, she had always thought of this house as she did of the cottages in fairy tales, full of secret cabinets and hidden stairs, and most of all, stories. It was an odd structure, out of kilter at every corner, an old lady plagued by arthritis but cheerful nonetheless. Front and kitchen doors and every window stood open to the breeze, because as old-fashioned as the house and Amelie herself might seem, she was keen on new inventions and had screens installed everywhere, bought from a man in Chicago and shipped at great expense, and worth every penny, she said when people asked. She would have paid more for fresh air without the flies and mosquitoes that plagued man and beast on a farm. While Amelie went about her business, Anna took the chance to study her cousin. The river of hair, iron and silver and black, in a long braid down her back, her clothes flowing and old-fashioned, worn soft and faded. In comparison, her complexion was far younger than her years, supple and smooth, still unlined. She was the daughter and granddaughter of slaves and slaveholders, of Mohawk and Seminole, and all those bloodlines had come together to a color that had entranced Anna as a very young child. It still reminded her of burning sugar, caramel on the verge of something even deeper. She remembered, vaguely, tasting the skin of Amelie's arm and coming away with simple salt on the tongue where she had expected sugar. Amelie disappeared into the pantry, raising her voice to be heard above the noise she was making, shifting through baskets and bins.
Tell me about your Jack.
First, tell me your news.
Amelie always had news of her sister, who lived in Boston, and had raised a family of 10 children who had, in turn, produced 18 children of their own, and of her brother, Henry, who was still working as an engineer on the railroads, though he was almost 70.
Can't slow him down. Takes after Da that way.
Her head appeared around the corner of the pantry.
Stop stalling now and tell me.
So Anna put together the story of Jack Mezzanotte, while Amelie gathered what she needed, mashed boiled ginger root, sorted through dried peppermint leaves, and put both to steep.
Mezzanotte, you say? Do his people keep bees? In Jersey somewhere?
Yes, Anna said. I should have realized you'd recognize the name.
I do, indeed. All right, I approve.
That made Anna laugh. Because his parents keep bees?
Because you do nothing by halves, Amelie said. And because it's clear to me that he did indeed sneak up on you, which means you let your guard down, and that tells me everything.
Hand me that tin, would you?
She put things on the table. A teapot with a mismatched lid, thick cups on chipped saucers, a jug of milk and a bowl of brown sugar lumps. Then she levered the lid off the cake tin so that the smells of browned butter and cardamom could slip out, like a genie released from a bottle. Amelie said,
Do you have a case for me?
No, Anna said, not today. But I have cases I wanted to tell you about, to get your opinion on.
She went to the sink to wash her hands, then dried them on the towel Amelie handed her. Amelie leaned back in her chair.
Start at the beginning, she said, and don't leave anything out.
When Anna had finished recounting all she knew about Janine Campbell, Abigail Liljestrom, and Eula Schmidt, Amelie went about cutting the cake. Anna let the silence stretch out. Patience with Amelie, because patience and patience alone would bring rewards.
I read about the Campbell inquest in the paper, Amelie said finally. Tell me, why didn't Sophie send the woman to me?
You know why, Anna said. We said we wouldn't send anybody until Comstock stops this campaign of his. Mrs. Campbell's husband actually works for Comstock. It was too dangerous. And in the end, your safety was more important to us.
You thought Comstock would follow her here?
Her cousin said. You know he does that kind of thing.
She rocked her head from side to side, considering.
So you think that the Campbell woman went to somebody who advertised himself as a reputable doctor but wasn't? You know that happens every day.
It's more than that, Anna said. Whoever did Janine Campbell's procedure was angry. It was more like a stabbing than anything else. I didn't see the postmortem, but I did read the Liljestrom autopsy report, and the similarities are hard to deny. Then this third case, and more of the same.
What does your Jack think?
Anna took a few moments to gather her thoughts.
He thinks there's a man, maybe a doctor, maybe not, who has a compulsion to do this to women. Somebody very intelligent, who plans ahead.
Does Jack know about me?
Anna had been waiting for this question, and she shook her head. Not yet.
He'll disapprove.
I think he'll withhold judgment until he meets you, and then he'll be satisfied.
That got her a smile.
Now that you'll have to explain.
He's unusual, Amelie. Because of his family background, he doesn't jump to condemnation, and he tries to see below the surface.
It's the reason we were drawn to each other, I think.
A perfect man? Hardly, Anna said, laughing. And I still haven't met all his family, so there may be trouble waiting there. In fact, I know there is.
This was not the time to talk about Bambina, though she would have liked to.
If you want my opinion, Jack may well be right in his suspicions about the way these three women died,
Amelie said. Anna had been expecting something less definitive.
Can you explain to me how you come to that conclusion? It just feels off to me, based on 40 years of looking after women. Do you have any suggestions on where to start? Any names?
Her cousin studied her teacup for a good while.
There was one doctor, 30 years ago or more. He wasn't young then, so he'll be long gone. But he was brutal with his patients, more bent on purifying their souls than saving their lives. I could imagine him letting a woman die. I think he probably did, and more than once. But that's a far cry from these cases of yours. Something like this takes a special kind of monster.
Anna retrieved the page of the newspaper she had brought with her from the city, and laying it in front of Amelie, pointed to the advertisement that had raised her suspicions. To the refined, dignified, but distraught lady departing Smithson's near the Jefferson Market yesterday morning. I believe I can provide the assistance you require. Write for particulars to Dr. DePaul, Station A, Union Square. When Amelie finished reading and looked up, Anna asked her a question.
Isn't Smithson the druggist who takes messages for Sarah?
It is, or it was. Sarah moved to Jersey to live with her son's family. She's unwell. She's 78 this past November. Anna gave her an apologetic half-smile.
I didn't realize. Did someone take over her practice?
I thought Nan did, Amelie said. You remember Nan Gray?
Vaguely. Is she one of yours?
Over the years, Amelie had trained or mentored 100 midwives, and she tried to keep track of all of them.
Not mine. She came up from Washington, maybe 20 years ago. But maybe she's not the one who stepped in for Sarah. You're thinking that this Dr. DePaul, whoever he is, watches for women coming out of Smithson's? That seems a very chancy way to set a trap. If that's what's going on,
Anna said, but it's written in such vague terms. Anyone might think themselves the target of his attention. If he only gets one response a month, that's probably more than he can deal with. I hope. Amelie hummed to herself as she poured more tea.
Practicing medicine requires a cynical turn of mind. But this...
She shook her head.
Let me understand you correctly. You think there's a man who trolls for women in distress, offers them his services, and operates in a way that assures that they don't survive, and even that they die in terrible pain. That his purpose is what? To punish them, to make examples of them.
I don't know, Anna said, but I have this sense that it would be a mistake to dismiss the possibility. Amelie went quiet, her head turned away as if she were looking out into the garden. But in fact, Anna knew she wasn't seeing anything at all. Her cousin had a way of climbing right inside a problem and sitting there until she found a way out. She had been trained by her own mother, Anna's Aunt Hannah, a doctor of almost mythic fame on the New York frontier, and it seemed to Anna that Amelie understood the minds of doctors as well as she did the women they cared for. She tapped the newspaper advertisement.
You know where to start.
I was thinking the same thing,
but it helped to talk it through with you. I'll send word if I make any progress. Now I have to go meet some 50 mezzanotes, so please wish me luck.
Luck is greatly overrated, said Amelie. Your native good sense will serve you far better.
The annual Italian Benevolent Society picnic and band concert was a popular event, one that might even overflow the boundaries of Washington Square Park. Since early in the morning, groups had been coming in on foot, carrying baskets or pushing wheeled carts, by omnibus or streetcar, others driving their own rigs. There were families from as far away as Long Island and Jersey City, street urchins watching for unattended purses and free meals, and police and roundsmen who strolled at a leisurely pace, stopping to watch a game of horseshoes. Elise sat with Chiara and Bambina on a bench on the corner opposite New York University, where the Mezzanotte family was busy getting ready. A familiar freight wagon stood at the curb, with Mezzanotte Brothers Greenwood, New Jersey painted on its side. Elise had first seen it waiting to cross an intersection not a block from where she sat now. Then it had been filled with flowers, but this time it carried benches and planks and barrels, boxes of linen and dishware, and baskets of food. The unloading was happening under the sharp eye of one of the Mezzanotte aunts, all in black, bent low by age. She ordered young men around with all the authority and finesse of Sister Xavier. The three of them had been spared physical labor, assigned instead to supervision of the runarounds, all the Mezzanotte children, or the children of Mezzanotte cousins old enough to walk, but less than four. They tumbled and rolled around on the grass, and occasionally made a break for freedom, often for no other reason than the joy of being chased by Chiara and Elise. Bambina stayed where she was, knitting lace from fine white thread as quickly and evenly as a machine. Knitting didn't slow down her conversation, though. Together with Bambina, they were giving Elise an education on all things Italian. Bambina pointed out families. The barber, Amadio, a widower with four married daughters, who lived in the same building and competed for his favor by feeding him multiple times every day. Maria Bella, who was already twice a widow at age 30. Signore Coniglio, who taught at the Italian school and talked all the time about becoming a priest, though he was more than 40. Joe Moretto, who had lost both legs fighting under Grant, but had managed to produce seven sons anyway. Elise paid attention, but knew that most of the names and faces would blend together by the end of the day. Just a little farther away, under trees in a pool of shade, the older ladies sat together gossiping and tending to the very youngest. Mrs. Quinlan and Margaret were there too, because the detective sergeant had made sure to find places for them next to his Aunt Filomena. There seemed to be a law that dictated black clothing for Italian women over a certain age, but Mrs. Quinlan wore a simple day dress of sprigged cotton, white flowers against a turquoise background, and looked like an exotic bird among the crows. The older men were playing a gentle game that reminded Elise of horseshoes, but with a ball. It looked interesting, but Italians were like everybody else, with strict ideas of where women belonged and where they didn't. Her place was here looking after the little ones. Beyond the very old and the very young, everyone had something to do. Every once in a while, Elise got a glimpse of Rosa and Leah in the middle of a small group of girls who had been given rags and piles of dishes to wipe. They were completely absorbed in this work, chattering with the other kids as if they had all grown up together. Children survived, if they had half a chance. Children who could form attachments survived best.
Look, said Chiara. Cesare is going to fall off the ladder and break his head.
The band pavilion was crowded with people arranging chairs and music stands. Younger men stood on ladders, hanging red, white, and green bunting on a frame. One of them was reaching so far that it did seem as if the ladder would tip.
Sicilian, Bambina said, frowning at her knitting. made of rubber.
They bounce. Her tone was not complimentary. Elise considered for a moment and then asked,
You don't like Sicilians?
A pained expression crossed Bambina's face.
I've got nothing against them, as long as they stay away from me.
Elise decided that it would be better to ask Jack about this. Bambina seemed to want to change the subject, too, because she decided that Elise needed to be able to identify all the band instruments being taken out of cases. She pointed out a sousaphone, trumpets, bassoons, clarinets, and three kinds of drums, every bit of brass and copper polished so that it reflected in the sun. At home in Vermont, Elise had known only fiddles and penny whistles,
and Mr. Esquibel's fipple flute, brought out at parties.
Once she entered the convent, she had heard no musical instruments beyond the organ. She knew that there were other kinds of instruments, but had never given them much thought. Certainly she hadn't imagined anything like this, especially when the band began to tune their instruments. All the sounds wound together like a badly pieced quilt, wavering up and down, and finally settling. The band leader was standing off to the side, all his attention taken up by an elegantly dressed older man. This, Chiara said in an almost reverent tone, was Mr. Moro, head of the Benevolent Society. Then Anna appeared out of nowhere, sliding in neatly between Bambina and Chiara. She had changed out of the very plain suit she wore when she left for the hospital to a summery gown. There was a layer of pale sea green, another with a faint narrow stripe in the same color, and an overdress printed with twining vines and budding flowers. The bodice of the overdress was constructed of panels that flowed into a split skirt. The back was just as striking, pleats falling from a graceful curved yoke at the shoulders. The whole effect was simple and somehow misleading. You might not notice how pretty it was, unless you took the time to look closely. And no doubt, some wouldn't bother, because it was completely out of fashion. Most of the Mezzanotte women were dressed like country women everywhere, in comfortable sleeveless bodices worn over linen blouses, wide skirts and aprons. Only Bambina wore something that might have come out of an illustrated magazine, not flamboyant, but very stylish, her skirts bunched at the sides to reveal a ruffled underskirt. Elise couldn't help herself from asking,
Dr. Savard, Anna, is that the dress you wore when you got married?
Chiara's whole posture changed, like a hunting dog coming across a promising scent. She was always wanting to know more about the quiet little wedding ceremony on Staten Island. Somehow, she didn't believe it could have been as simple as both Anna and Jack claimed. Bambina was just as curious. Chiara knew that for a fact. But she wore a more studiously disinterested expression.
No, Anna said. Remind me later, and I'll show you what dress I was wearing.
It was nothing out of the ordinary, Chiara. We didn't set out that day with plans to marry. Chiara's expression was resigned. But then she asked a question Elise would never have known how to put into an acceptable form.
Why do you dress like you do? Don't you care about fashion?
Anna didn't take offense easily, it seemed. She said, Mostly it has to do with my work. Tight bodices and narrow skirts are the last thing you want in an operating room. You have to be able to move freely. When I'm not working, I can't see the logic in being uncomfortable either. Bambina said,
Anna belongs to the Rational Dress Society, the one that is so radical about what women wear. They'd have us all in trousers if they ruled the world.
And we'd be more comfortable, Anna said dryly. But really, the Rational Dress Society isn't so extreme as you think. You should come with me to a meeting, Bambina. The look on Bambina's face was almost comical, but she was spared answering, because the detective sergeant was walking toward them. He had taken off his suit jacket and vest to reveal emerald green suspenders over a white shirt, his sleeves folded up to reveal muscular forearms. Elise had little experience of men beyond her father and brothers and priests, but she could see why Jack Mezzanotte was considered handsome. It was more than his features. It had to do with the way he moved, the energy and purpose of him. Right now, he was coming for Anna, and Elise wondered what that would be like, to have a man look at her with such obvious affection and pleasure. He stopped right in front of Anna, and bending down, kissed her cheek. This was nothing out of the ordinary for Italians, as Elise had observed. They hugged and kissed as a matter of course, men just as unself-consciously as women. Men kissed brothers and sons and nephews, clasping hands on both shoulders. Mothers and sisters, aunts and young children were kissed more gently, sometimes with an arm looped around the neck. And still, this kiss was different. Because she was sitting so close, Elise saw exactly how it fell. The touch of his mouth not to cheek or jaw, or even to mouth, but high on Anna's neck, below her ear. It was simple and devastating. A gesture that spoke of possession and passion. She felt her own cheeks flushing with color, as Anna's did.
"Savard," Jack said with a smile. "Let's go."
He stood back, pulling her up to walk with him. She went without protest, and only the slightest hint of hesitation.
"Elise," Jack said, "come and meet my family."
To her surprise, she heard herself stutter, I'm needed here."
"Go ahead," Chiara said. "We'll cope just fine."
Because there was no way to remember all the names and faces, Elise simply didn't try, and really, it didn't matter. The detective sergeant's family members were mostly interested in Anna, which was to be expected. What did surprise her was Anna's easy way of handling it all. She remained calm and friendly, concentrating completely on whoever was in front of her in the moment, answering questions with no trace of the impatience she would show if an orderly moved too slowly or a nurse was less than precise. Another surprise was that all of Jack's generation spoke English without any trace of accent, and none of them talked Italian among themselves, at least not when Anna and Elise were nearby. Out of courtesy or as a matter of course, that was hard to tell. The one exception was Carmela, the wife of Jack's second oldest brother. Her English seemed hard won, something she used because it was expected of her, a chore to be gotten out of the way. Carmela had a baby on her hip, a little girl called Lolo, who clung like a monkey. She had huge bright eyes and a shock of black hair, and she smiled toothlessly at everyone who stopped to admire her. Lolo first looked at Elise solemnly, her forehead creased. Then she leaned forward and launched herself as though she could fly. Elise caught her neatly, looking to her mother to see if she might be taking offense. "She's never seen a redhead, I take it," and then touching her own hair, "Sono rossa." "Yes," Carmela smiled, "she will pull your red hairs." Elise tilted her head down for the baby's examination. "What's a little hair pulling between friends?" Jack had warned Anna that the importance of food in Italian culture could not be underestimated. But Anna had managed somehow to do just that. The bowls and platters would have fed everyone in the park, but every now and then another rig would pull up and disgorge relatives who carried steaming pots and covered dishes. All the adults had gathered around one long table, while children were seated at another, close enough to keep an eye on, but not so close that they drowned out adult conversation. A few older nieces were stationed there to make sure high spirits didn't get in the way of eating. Babies had been put down for naps on blankets, with a couple of dogs on alert nearby.
"Jude's primarily a sheep farmer," Jack explained. "His dogs do double duty on days like this, keeping track of the kids and making sure they don't get too close to the fire pits."
A lamb and a young pig had been turning on spits since the early morning. the aroma would have caused poorly trained dogs to abandon their duties. But Jude's animals lay very still, only the twitching of noses giving away their interest. Anna had less control, and was glad that the growling of her stomach could not be heard over the many voices. She passed her plate and watched as it was filled, determined not to make a fuss about the amount of food put down in front of her. She would try everything on her plate, take careful note of textures and tastes, and ask questions. There would be a test later, she knew. Many tests to come, and she had no intention of failing even one of them. So she ate and talked and ate. Between sips of red wine, she ate a salad of tomatoes tossed with soft cheese and bread and olive oil, wild boar sausage and wide noodles cooked with artichokes and capers, white beans and marinated mushrooms, pork slathered with garlic and lemon and rosemary. They ate and talked and ate and talked and ate. Small bites, long pauses to ask questions and answer more. Jack said, "Look over there. Do you see the boy sitting at the end of the table next to Rosa?" Anna did and said so. "You don't recognize him." She didn't and said that too. But then she looked more closely. 12 years old in her estimation, thin but properly nourished, his color high, the very picture of health. Hoboken. That's the boy who wanted to find work to save money for passage home.
Santino Bacigalup, you're right. Looks like a different boy, doesn't he?
Jack's mother leaned toward them.
Good food, sunshine, a safe place to sleep. He's a hard worker, that one. I wrote to his sister in Palermo for him, but we haven't had word back yet.
It's been 2 months, Anna said. That day in Hoboken seemed even longer ago, and in some ways, not so long at all.
No cause for worry, said her mother-in-law. His sister probably had to take the letter to her priest so he could read it to her, and then she'll tell him what to say and he'll write back. It's the way things work.
But if you don't hear back...
Then he stays with us, Jack's brother Leo said. He's already like a brother to my boys. And he loves Carmela and Lolo. She follows him around with her eyes, wherever he goes.
He's a fortunate boy, Anna said. We still don't know what became of Rosa and Leah's brother Tonino. He could be anywhere or nowhere. If he was sent west on one of the orphan trains, we'll never know what happened to him. Jack, she said, as a thought occurred to her, have you told your mother about Vittorio?
I mentioned it.
Do you have an opinion, Mrs. Mezzanotte? Her mother-in-law put down her fork with an unhappy little click.
You are uncomfortable calling me Mama.
Anna felt a dozen eyes turning in her direction.
Ma,
Jack began, but Anna put a hand on his wrist. Let me answer. It has to do mostly with my own mother. I don't remember her very clearly. Just a sense of her face and her voice. But I hold on to those small things, and wouldn't want to lose them.
It would feel disloyal to call someone else Mama.
No, not exactly. It's like... She tried to make her voice sound matter-of-fact. It feels like admitting that she's gone, and if I do that, she will be. It makes no logical sense, I know.
It makes every kind of sense, said Mrs. Mezzanotte. My mother died 35 years ago, and every once in a while I still dream about her scolding me because I don't come visit often enough.
Yes, Anna said, like that.
I understand, but you can't call me Mrs. Mezzanotte. It's too formal. You will call me Rachel to start.
Rachel. Anna said, thank you. I was wondering if you have an opinion about Vittorio Russo.
My opinion is, there is no easy solution to this problem. There are too many hearts